from WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. An average of 130 Americans die every day from an opioid overdose. That's according to the National Center for Health Statistics. And earlier this year, a different report concluded that Americans are now more likely to die from an opioid overdose than from a car accident. The overdose reversal drug naloxone, or Narcan, has become an important tool in efforts to reduce those overdose deaths. All 50 states now allow paramedics to administer Narcan, and many allow other emergency responders and even bystanders to give the drug. Not surprisingly, the number of reported overdose reversals has more than doubled. But the cost of Narcan can be an obstacle for some communities' efforts to increase its availability and use. Making Narcan also has some nasty environmental effects, water usage and toxic chemical waste. Now, researchers at the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center in St. Louis say they've found a more cost-efficient and sustainable way to manufacture naloxone, using an enzyme from bacteria. Tony Kuchen is the Oliver M. Langenberg Distinguished Investigator and Vice President for Research at the Danforth Center. She leads that research. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Tony, let's start with super basics. I guess I hadn't realized that Narcan is actually an opioid derivative. It's actually made from a chemical in opium.
Yes. So the drug naloxone is made from opium poppy, as are a number of other painkillers and other opiate overdose treatment drugs.
So walk me through the traditional manufacturing process. How do you get from an opium poppy to Narcan, naloxone?
Opium poppy makes a number of different drugs. It makes morphine, it produces codeine, and it produces another compound that's called thebaine, which in and of itself is not a drug. And that thebaine is used as a starting material for manufacturing a whole series of opiate-based painkillers and drug overdose treatments.
And how do you actually get from the thebaine to the naloxone, the overdose reversal drug?
Drugs like thebaine or drug precursors are extracted from the opium poppy, and then those compounds are chemically modified, going through a series of steps to produce the various drugs that we're familiar with in the pharmacy. Those are all done by chemistry today.
And Narcan use, as I noted, has skyrocketed in the past few years. I guess that's as good a thing as we could hope for in this situation. How much of an issue is the cost? I mean, if we had to break it down, you know, per dose of Narcan, what's the cost and what's the environmental footprint of Narcan?
So the process to change these various compounds that you get out of opium poppy into the specific drugs or drug treatments are based on removing a certain chemical entity from a nitrogen. And that particular process is very severe chemistry. And it is a type of chemistry that is not particularly good for the chemistry workers in the factory, and it's not good for the environment because the waste stream has to be treated very strongly to get rid of those toxic components. So we concentrated on that one step in multi-step process to come up with a greener method of doing it. And that caused us to look to microorganisms that produce interesting enzymes that could, in a very efficient and clean way, remove that chemical entity so that the rest of the process can happen to put on the new chemical entities to that nitrogen to either make it a different kind of painkiller or a different kind of overdose treatment.
Well, Tony Kuchen, you found a bacteria with an enzyme that can do that one chemical reaction. You found that bacteria in the waste from opiate processing. I mean, why is that where you turn to look for a potential solution?
Yes, this is a novel concept to go to the environment of the plant, either the soil that's surrounding the plant, and in our case, it was the waste stream. So after the plant material has been extracted, that waste stream goes out into a sludge pond, and it stays there until it's detoxified. So the soil microorganisms are able to feed on the leftover drug material that's in that waste pond. So it was a good guess that if we wanted something that was going to modify drugs, it was going to be the microorganisms in that waste pond that have evolved over time to be able to basically degrade the leftover drug material in the pond.
How did you actually end up finding the one bacterium that you wanted? I mean, you take a whole bunch of this sludge into the lab and what, look for which flask, which vial actually turns thebaine into naloxone, and there you have it?
Exactly. So we take sludge and we put it into a flask, and the only carbon source is the drug thebaine in the flask. And with time, something can start to grow. And then we take that whole mixture and we start doing serial dilutions until we get single species of microbes. And then each single species is put into a new flask with only thebaine in it as a carbon source, and we see what can grow. And we ended up in the end with a single bacterium species that can degrade thebaine. And it happened to be doing exactly what we were looking for, which was taking the methyl group off the nitrogen so that the molecule can be further modified to other drugs.
So then what is the idea for putting this into a manufacturing setting? Grow huge vats of that bacteria and then harvest the chemicals out of that?
I think there's several possibilities for how to go forward. One possibility is, yes, to grow up the microorganism that contains the enzyme, or we could purify the enzyme out of the microbe. A third possibility that's been in the news the past couple of years is the idea of producing plant-based drugs in yeast or bacteria in synthetic biology systems, and our gene can just be introduced into that yeast or that bacterium that contains all the other machinery to make the drug, and then instead of making thebaine, the bacterium or the yeast would make norethebaine. And it can be further processed chemically then to whatever drug you want.
Tony Kuchen, we don't usually think of the opioid addiction crisis as an environmental issue, but of course your work is trying to decrease the environmental footprint of manufacturing presumably both painkillers and naloxone, the overdose reversal drug. How much of a reduction are we talking in the environmental footprint of that process?
I think we're not able to give you numbers at this point. I think to be able to do that, we would have to know from industry that does the manufacturing exactly what the costs are for the methods that they're using, and then see how many steps we're replacing and how much of the environmental cleanup we've eliminated by using the enzyme. And access to that information at this point we don't have.
Obviously, there's still many steps to go before you could put this into action in a manufacturing setting. But you do already have a patent on the enzyme, right? So what are your next steps?
Our next steps are actively looking for partners that will aid us in what's an engineering feat going forward, producing more of the enzyme and in a form that is appropriate to industrial manufacturing.
This one project, trying to figure out how to use bacteria and enzymes to more sustainably manufacture Narcan, is just one of the research projects that you have going. Your general philosophy is trying to use more natural processes. Give us a sense of how different you think some of our manufacturing processes could be. What range of manufacturing processes are we talking about being able to benefit from plants and microbes to do things in a different way?
I think that the range of manufacturing processes in the pharma industry are enormous, right? This is really a large number of compounds, whether they're plant-based drugs or whether they're chemically produced drugs, that could benefit from replacing select steps that are either particularly polluting steps or inefficient steps with enzymes that are either derived from plants or are derived from the microbiome associated with the plant. Pharma has just been a little bit slow to adopt these greener initiatives and to introduce enzymes into the manufacturing process compared to other industries. So yes, far and wide ranging if one put effort into it.
That is Toni Kuchen. She is the Vice President for Research and Oliver M. Langenberg Distinguished Investigator at the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center in St. Louis. Thanks so much, Toni.
Thank you.
Up next, measles outbreaks are never a good thing, but they could be a sign of progress in some countries. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Measles was declared eliminated from the U.S. almost 20 years ago. And yet this year, there have been over 1,000 confirmed cases of measles in the U.S. Outbreaks in New York and the Pacific Northwest have drawn attention to falling vaccination rates in some communities, and the situation has sparked widespread fear and concern. Outbreaks in other countries this year have also gotten tangled up in that fear and concern. And to be clear, measles outbreaks are never a good thing. But in some of those cases, the outbreaks may actually be an indication that the country is getting closer to eliminating measles. Matthew Ferrari is an associate professor of biology at Penn State University. Along with his colleague Amy Winter, he has described a boom-bust pattern of measles outbreaks that precedes disease elimination. He's published that work recently in the journal Science and also wrote about it for TheConversation.com. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
What you write is that the road to the elimination of measles is predictable, but not necessarily a straight downward line, that it's not just that the number of cases steadily decreases as vaccination rates go up, but that in fact, the variability in the number of cases from year to year can actually increase. I mean, talk more about this pattern.
Yeah, I think there's really two important things to see in this. So one, when vaccination coverage is quite low and measles is prevalent everywhere, then the number of cases from year to year are always high. And so you always know what you're going to get into. And as vaccination coverage increases and programs become more successful, you decrease the total number of measles cases happening in any given year, and that's a great thing. But what also happens is the year-to-year variability tends to increase. You tend to have some years with very little cases and some years with more cases, and that happens for predictable reasons. If you have a year where there's no big outbreak, right? Well, what that means is that a lot of those kids that were born in that year weren't exposed to measles. And so they're going to be susceptible again in the following year and the year after and the year after. And then you add those to the children that weren't vaccinated. And all of a sudden you have a much bigger population of kids that are susceptible. And eventually an outbreak is going to catch that population. What we really need to be paying attention to is how many kids are susceptible, how many kids haven't been vaccinated, how many kids haven't been naturally immunized by natural infection. And really that those are, you know, a much harder thing to measure in the real world, right? Cases we see.
Obviously, there are clear reasons, explanations for this pattern. How did you actually discover this pattern? Is this something that has been seen with other diseases and is well known, or was this something that kind of surprised you?
Some of it is just as a function of years and years of looking at surveillance data from measles outbreaks and what the time series of measles looks like in successful countries and unsuccessful countries. All the people that were involved in this project have been working on measles for a long time, and we just saw this pattern over and over and over again. So that's one thing. The second is, in fact, this is a really, really general pattern in all kinds of what we call dynamical systems, where tomorrow's outcome depends on today's outcome and maybe on the outcome of the day before. And as you get really, really close to what we call these tipping points, then that increases in variability is a common phenomenon. So what we're looking for in measles is that level of elimination, right? We want to get populations to have high enough vaccination coverage so that we achieve herd immunity and natural infection sort of dies out on its own. That's the beauty of herd immunity, right? It says that you don't actually have to immunize 100% of people. You just have to get that number high enough. And the indirect benefit of vaccination of most people will protect the unvaccinated individuals that you didn't get to. And so we're just trying to get to that point, and we're looking for where that point is. And that increased variability that we're seeing is actually indicative of approaching that point. So if you actually think about it, rather than thinking about it as a negative consequence, think about it as a positive thing, we can actually use this to help identify where that tipping point really is. Now, if you read a lot of the popular literature on measles and a lot of the articles that have been written over the last probably 10 years since we've seen more variability in the United States. You see standard numbers that get repeated over and over again, right? You hear 95% vaccination, right? We need to vaccinate 95% of people in order to achieve herd immunity, right? And slowly over the last 5 years, we've been trying to change that messaging because the epidemiologists that work on this have always known that 95% vaccination is not the right terminology, right? It's really 95% immunity.
So what's the difference there between 95% vaccination and 95% immunity?
Right. So not every single dose of vaccine works, right? There are a lot of reasons for that. Some of it is sometimes you give a dose of vaccine to a young child who still has the protective maternal antibodies that they got from their mom. And so the vaccine doesn't work. You just gave it to them a little bit too early. And if you gave it to them a month or two later on, right, then they would have lost that maternal immunity and their body would be more likely to stimulate an immune response. So what we really want to achieve is 95% of children that are immunized, which means that we actually need to vaccinate more than 95% of children.
Well, Matthew Farr, I want to go back to your analysis and this idea of the outbreaks and the boom-bust cycle of infections or cases increasing as you get closer to that tipping point. Is the tipping point the 95% immunization rate, or does the tipping point happen a little bit sooner, a little bit later? Where is that point?
Yeah. So again, I think that roughly on average across all countries, it is pretty close to that 95%, their 95% immunity, not vaccination, right? But it's not exactly 95% for all countries. Really what this lays out is now our ability to characterize the average path for all countries and then start to look at what's the individual path for any one country and how does that compare relative to the average across all countries. And even if it's still hard to identify the exact number for any one country, maybe we can at least rank countries. And we can say, well, here's a country that is behaving like its tipping point is a little bit higher or its tipping point is a little bit lower, right? And we can then allocate resources in a more judicious or efficient manner, right, to be able to basically just push countries across that tipping point.
So let's do a little bit of that and actually rank some countries and see where they are on this pathway to elimination. Let's start with the U.S. The outbreaks that we've seen this year, to you, are those a sign that the U.S. is close to the tipping point, or are they a sign that the U.S. is backsliding away from elimination?
To me, they're a sign that the U.S. is backsliding towards that tipping point, but from the other side. So there's two ways to get to a tipping point, right? You can be on the high incidence, high measles, endemic side, and you can be on the elimination side, right? Now, most of the Americas, including the United States, have been on the elimination side, right? And what we've been seeing more recently is those countries moving backwards away from the successes that they've enjoyed.
So this is not a one-way path, and once you go over the tipping point, you're good. You can actually go back over the tipping point and start seeing measles increasing again.
That's right, yeah. We call this a path for a reason, right? This is a path, not a recipe. If there was a recipe for measles elimination, that would mean I do this, I do this, I do this, and I get there, right? This is just the path. You know, you're going to have to go through this pattern in order to get there. There are a million ways that you can move forward or backward on that path, and there are more effective and less effective strategies that can be used to move quickly or slowly along that path, right? But no matter what you do, you're always going to see this phenomenon of, as cases drop, variation is going to increase. And then once you cross that tipping point, variation is going to then drop precipitously.
Well, Matthew Ferrari, let's turn our attention to some of the other countries where we've seen outbreaks. Are they in this same position of backsliding, or are they just, this is the sign that they're actually progressing toward that tipping point? I keep thinking about this like a waterfall, like they're coming down the river and they're almost to that tipping point. And so they're in the white water with these boom busts, these big outbreaks before they hit that tipping point and get to elimination.
Yeah, I think most of the other big outbreaks that we've seen this year, countries like Madagascar, Philippines, Ukraine and Congo have all been on the sort of pre-elimination side of that tipping point. And yeah, what we're seeing is an indication that those countries are improving. We're seeing increased vaccination coverage in all of those countries, and the corresponding variation in outbreak sizes that we would expect to see associated with that. But again, I wouldn't want to suggest that those big outbreaks are a good thing, right? They might be an indication that we're getting closer to the tipping point, but they're still really significant and really severe public health emergencies that should be addressed specifically, and we should try and mitigate as much as possible.
Is this pattern that you have described now for the process, I guess, of eliminating measles precise enough to be able to use this as a diagnostic tool for countries to look at that and see where they are on the path?
I hope it will be, but I'm cautious of making overly grandiose statements. I think that as with any set of indicators, it's as precise as we have now. And the hope is that as time goes on, we will make it more precise. And I think that the way to make it more precise is to add additional variables into it. There are a number of other variables that we know tend to be associated with patterns as we get closer to elimination. So we tend to see changes in the relative proportion of cases among children versus adolescents versus adults. We tend to see patterns in how variable the spatial extent of an outbreak is. So does it affect the whole country? Is it really patchy only into small areas? Those kinds of things. The challenge with using some of those other variables is that they're not uniformly collected in all countries. And so the reason that we used these two variables alone right now was because they were consistently available for all countries. And once we can do that, then we can do not just a better job of being precise about any one country, but we can also be better at ranking or doing a relative ranking of countries. And again, that's oftentimes the most important thing, right? Is not, you don't necessarily need to know exactly where any one country is. You just need to know which country is at the top of the list and which country is at the bottom of the list, and then rank your investments accordingly.
Although you also note that this could be a tool for countries to find other countries in a similar position or perhaps a little bit ahead of them on the path and say, hey, what worked for you? What might be a good recipe for us?
Exactly right. And I think that's what we really want to do. And I think that's one of the really powerful uses of surveillance is to sort of give a really sort of objective basis for a conversation among countries and a conversation among the aid organizations and public health organizations. Right. So rather than basing everything only in anecdote, right, and stories about this outbreak or that outbreak, right? Can we come up with a really sort of objective set of classifications, an objective set of variables so that you can say, okay, we're here. What were you doing? What were the strategies you were using? Were you really focusing on investments in routine vaccination? Were you doing child and maternal health days? Were you doing supplemental campaigns that were based in schools, right? Or were you doing supplemental campaigns that were based in community centers? How much engagement did you use, did you rely on with community health workers, right? With traditional healers for getting messaging out to the population, right? I mean, again, it is all about vaccination, but that grossly simplifies how you get vaccination out there.
Matthew Ferrari is an associate professor of biology at Pennsylvania State University and co-author of a recent study in the journal Science and also a piece on theconversation.com about the patterns that we see as countries move towards the elimination of measles. Matthew, thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, thank you for the opportunity. This has been great.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Apollo astronauts brought home nearly 850 pounds of rocks and soil from the moon. Those samples forced scientists to throw out much of what they thought they knew about the moon, what it's made of and how it got there. And that collection continues to be a staple of lunar research. After all, it's all we've got. Now, with the upcoming 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, NASA is releasing three new samples for study. Samuel Lawrence is the lead scientist for lunar exploration at NASA's Johnson Space Center. He's part of the group that takes care of the lunar rock collection and oversees its use for research. Samuel, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
introduce us to this actual collection. I mean, 850 pounds of moon rocks and soil. What does it look like? How big are the rocks? What kinds of rocks are they?
They tend to be rocks very similar to terrestrial rocks, shockingly enough. And that makes sense when you think about it, because the Earth and Moon were formed at the same time, 4.4-ish billion years ago. And they tend to, they have identical oxygen isotope ratios, and we're fairly convinced that they were once part of the same planet at one point. And so it makes sense. And then we have all these rocks in their soils, and there's some volcanic rocks, and there's another class of rocks called impact breccias, which tend to be things that were created in the impact process by when asteroids or comets hit the moon.
I mean, it makes sense, as you say, now to us to think that rocks on the moon are fairly similar to rocks on Earth. But when those rocks and soil first came back, that forced a real reckoning in the science community. That hadn't been the thought or the expectation. So take us back 50 years. What was the previous thought about where the moon had come from and what those rocks maybe would have been expected to be like?
It's interesting because if you look back in the 50s, people had no idea what the moon was. And there was, some people thought the moon had just been captured by, just been a large asteroid that was just, wandering by and got captured by the Earth's gravity field. And people, it was a topic of debate. Some people, saw these things that looked like dried out riverbeds on the moon and thought the moon might have had oceans at one point. We really didn't know. And it's safe to say that the field work performed by the Apollo astronauts on the moon and the samples they collected really did revolutionize our understanding of the universe. It changed our whole perspective on what other planets are and how to study them. There's a famous story where a famous scientist who was very well regarded and won a Nobel Prize was watching the first moon landing right here at JSC in Mission Control and was getting very angry because the astronauts were more or less proving his theories wrong in real time. He's like, they're not finding what they're supposed to find. And, and that's because, he had guessed wrong. That's what science is, right? If you knew what everything was, you wouldn't need to go explore. This is why we put robots and astronauts on the pointy end of rockets and send them into the heavens.
So what is the controversial at the time theory that the moon rocks kind of forced into acceptance among scientists about where the moon had come from if it wasn't just a body that had wandered by and fallen into Earth's gravity?
So it turned out that the moon was very much like Earth. It has a crust, it has a mantle and a core. The idea was the cold moon versus the so-called hot moon or warm moon, and it turned out that the warm moon folks were right. The moon has very much like the Earth. It's a differentiated planet. It has very much like Mars and Venus and Mercury, just in smaller scales. And it really is a great laboratory for understanding how planets form and differentiate. And again, we didn't really know that before we went to the moon, but then after we went to the moon, we did.
Samuel Lawrence, how have the samples that are in that collection been used in the intervening 50 years between that initial obvious flurry of interest and research and the present day?
If you look at what happened in the 60s, many of the techniques that we now take for granted for looking at rocks on this planet, terrestrial rocks, many of them are sort of in nascent stages in the mid-1960s, but were really pushed forward in advance by the investments that NASA made in preparing for the Apollo samples. And in 1968, there was a meteorite that fell in Mexico called Allende, and as a test bed, many samples of Allende were studied in the laboratories around the United States, where many of these techniques, like electron microprobe analysis, comes to mind as a commonly used technique now. Most universities have electron microprobes, but in the 60s, they were still relatively rare. And so the Apollo samples were in many ways pushed forward laboratory analyses of terrestrial geological samples in a very useful way for all aspects of the science. I won't say it was the only reason why those things advanced, but it was certainly a driver in the 1960s. And that really speaks to the value of keeping return samples and curating them and distributing them to the research community. Because over the past 50 years, laboratory analysis techniques have increased dramatically as computers have become more common, as scientists and engineers invent new ways to look at things at micron scales and even nano scales, nanometer scales. Technology increases. The samples, are still here, but everything around them in terms of laboratory and analysis techniques improves dramatically. And that's one of the reasons why the Apollo samples have been so useful for so long, and that it's It's because as our understanding of the Apollo landing sites increases, as we take the field work performed by the astronauts and then correlate it to orbiting missions like the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, presently in orbit around the Moon, and Clementine, as we understand more about lunar geology, we can put the samples into their context, understand more about where they came from, but we can also apply these new laboratory techniques to understand them and reevaluate them in the context of new discoveries. And I think the best, most recent example of that is, you know, when I was in graduate school, the Moon was bone dry. No one thought that there was any water. We thought there might be some trapped ice at the lunar poles, but nobody thought that the lunar interior had any so-called magmatic or endogenous water in the mantle. Well, sure enough, in the late, you know, in 2008 and 2010 and 2012, we found them. We leveraged advances I personally didn't find it, but members of the scientific community did. And scientists using new analytical laboratory techniques found evidence for an endogenic water in lunar magmatic activity. And that changed our whole understanding of what the Moon is, how it formed, how lunar volcanism behaves, and that's the kind of sample that literally nobody thought was, or that's the kind of discovery that literally nobody thought was even possible, not even 20 years ago. So, you know, that speaks to the benefit of keeping a large, of the current Apollo collection, but it also speaks to why we need to go get more samples.
Well, Samuel Lawrence, given all of the research that has been done on the rocks collected by the Apollo astronauts, obviously there are too many findings and too much learning to put it into a few sentences. But just on the question of where the Moon came from, what's our most recent understanding? If you had to kind of encapsulate the theory of the Moon that has come from these samples, what would that be?
It's a good question, and it turns out we can actually probably put it into words. The Moon probably formed in a giant impact by a Mars-sized impactor with the primordial Earth about 4.4 billion years ago. And people differ on the details. I mean, you can make models and run computer simulations, but in general, the particulars of this theory are pretty well accepted, and it's a generally accepted scientific hypothesis in the scientific community. And again, that was something nobody really would have predicted in the 60s and 70s, but we can say that now based on the Apollo and Luna samples that we have back in our laboratories. The other very interesting thing is that the Moon, on Earth we have plate tectonics, and, you know, so things, rocks are continuously recycled into the mantle. They erupt. If you've sat through a high school or introductory geology class in college, you've probably heard about this concept, you know, like as plates subduct and volcanoes erupt. But on the Moon, there are no plate tectonics. And so the Moon really records that first billion years of solar system history where life was rising on Earth. And it's not preserved on Earth, not really. So to really understand how we came to be, you really do have to go to the Moon. The Moon is our best witness plate for that vital first billion years of solar system history.
Well, Samuel Lawrence, as we are contemplating the possibility of a return mission to the Moon, obviously that's got to be very exciting for you and your colleagues. With some of the open questions, as you were just mentioning, both about early history of the Earth, where the water in the Moon came from or what its significance is, these are big questions. Are they questions that our current samples can answer, or do we need other samples and do we know what those are? What would you send astronauts to the Moon to get if you could right now?
So that's actually a really good question. And the Apollo astronauts only directly explored. We only landed on the Moon 6 times. The Apollo astronauts only directly explored an area roughly the size of a suburban shopping mall in total. And it also turns out that the Apollo landing sites really are not representative of the Moon as a whole. And so to really understand and answer some of these big picture questions about the Moon and how Earth formed and the rise of life on Earth, we really do need to go to more places on the Moon and explore with astronauts and robots to understand some of these big questions. Because turns out we didn't really go to any place, as many places, on the Moon as you might have expected based on the 6 landings back in the 70s. And it makes sense because the Moon has the same surface area as the continent of Africa. If you were some visitor from outer space and you just landed in the Grand Canyon and you tried to say, oh, this is everywhere on Earth is exactly like this. You'd be wrong. And that turns out to be pretty much what happened on the moon, too. And the other interesting thing about the moon is that one of the bigger discoveries that came out of the Apollo program was that the moon has resources which could enable its eventual settlement by human beings. And so especially in terms of results from the Clementine mission and also from Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, it appears likely that not only are there possible ice deposits or volatile deposits, I should say, trapped into lunar polar regions, but there's vast lunar ore deposits that we can access and which potentially could be commercially viable. And so as we start to talk about how to explore the moon and Mars and asteroids and everywhere else you want to send astronauts to in a sustainable and affordable way, living off the land and learning how to live and work in other planets in ways that don't break the bank and don't require massive multi-year, commitments of funds and resources, but can possibly be self-sustaining and possibly even profit-making, I think is really important. And that's a new way of thinking for space, but I think we have an opportunity now to try it. And let's see if it works. Let's see if we can do this on time and on budget. So I think that's pretty exciting.
Samuel Lawrence is the lead scientist for lunar exploration at NASA's Johnson Space Center. He's part of the group that takes care of the lunar rock collection and oversees its use for research. Samuel, thanks so much for talking with us.
No, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Senior military officials and analysts have said for some time that climate change poses national security risks. Sea level rise and extreme weather are threats to military infrastructure, and droughts and floods exacerbated by climate change can fuel unrest and conflict that might engage our military. So it's perhaps ironic that the armed forces are a massive consumer of fossil fuels and a source of greenhouse gas emissions. If the Department of Defense were a country, it would be the 55th largest emitter globally. But it could be worse. DoD has made huge strides in reducing its carbon footprint, cutting emissions by almost a third in just 13 years. Still, there's more work to be done. And my next guest says there's a case to be made for decarbonizing the military. Nita Crawford is co-director of the Costs of War Project based at the Watson Institute at Brown University. She is a professor of political science at Boston University and a board member of the Council for a Livable World. She's written about the carbon footprint of the military for theconversation.com. Nita, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
So, Nita, the Department of Defense is the world's largest consumer of oil. Where does it all go?
Well, much of it goes to operations, that is, flying things about. Jet fuel is the largest element of the consumption of the fossil fuels. But there's also diesel used to power installations, liquid propane gas, natural gas. They use, even today, coal.
And you mentioned fueling airplanes being the largest chunk of that. I mean, the mileage of a military jet is pretty abysmal.
Right. They get on the order of gallons per mile. So let's say a B-2.
Not miles per gallon, gallons per mile.
Right. Gallons per mile. Hard to wrap your head around. So they get about 4.2 gallons per mile. That is a B-2. And let's say the latest F-35 fighter bomber is much better, only consuming 2.3 gallons per mile. But as you can see, that's not a great fuel economy rate, no matter how you look at it.
When we're talking about the carbon footprint of the military, how much of that is going to actively fighting wars, being engaged in conflicts, and how much of it is just flying planes and driving vehicles around, perhaps to be prepared or just as training in the normal operations of the military?
Okay, so the Department of Defense thinks about it as installations and bases, and that's about 30% of the fuel usage. And then there's what they call the operational usage, and that's 70%. So that is war-related.
Well, Nita Crawford, you've released a new analysis of fuel consumption and the resulting greenhouse gas emissions from 1975 through 2017. Let's start with the most recent numbers. The military emitted 59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases in 2017. I mean, obviously, that's a big number. What is that like in terms of the number of cars on the road or something we might be able to wrap our heads around?
Oh, I think it's 247 million cars or something like that. I actually don't have that number at the tip of my tongue. It's so large.
Going over time, I mean, how has that number changed? While we said 59 million metric tons is a really large number, that has fluctuated over time.
That's right. In 1975, the first year for which I had records, the total emissions were 109 million metric tons. So they've dramatically decreased. Of course, there's been fluctuation. So when the military is at war or at a high level of mobilization, let's say in preparation to war or drawing down from war, their consumption goes up. So it was up, for instance, in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, when the United States was at a peak of fighting. And then it went up again in the period when the United States surged in Iraq and then later in Afghanistan. But as the U.S. military draws down its military activities and reduces forces in a region, the consumption has gone down. But there's also been, part of the explanation of the dramatic decrease is a decreased use of coal and fuel oil at installations. That's a big part of the story.
You also note that a big part of the story is the fact that of the operations that the military is conducting at any given time, a lot of effort and therefore fuel goes to this kind of circular act of defending our oil interests and our access to foreign oil. Were you able to drill in and figure out if that particular usage has increased or decreased over time?
Well, the way to understand that is thinking about 1979 as the point when the United States turned to using a great deal of its resources to defend access to Persian Gulf oil and to protect interest in that region. And that's because after the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and there was the Iranian hostage crisis, the United States feared that some power could try to control the Persian Gulf. And then over time, the United States has changed the name of the mission. The mission itself really hasn't changed. But at the same time, the U.S. has got a more diverse source of petroleum oil, in that the United States' own production of petroleum has increased and it gets more petroleum resources from Canada and elsewhere. And the United States' use of renewable energies has increased. So the overall need for Persian Gulf oil has decreased. But there's been no rethink of the mission.
Nita Crawford, the piece that you wrote for TheConversation.com is in large part making the case for decarbonizing the military. And you point out that, of course, if we reduced the military's reliance on oil, that would reduce the need to use fuel, to use oil and create greenhouse gases, defending access to oil. So there's kind of, you know, that circle could feed in the other direction if we were to reduce the fossil fuel reliance of the military. What are some of the other arguments for decarbonizing the military beyond just the broader consensus that, you know, we need to reduce emissions from everything in order to limit climate change?
Well, one reason is the one that the Pentagon gives for decreasing their own fossil fuel consumption. The United States is vulnerable when it has to transport fuel, let's say, into a war zone. And in fact, that's been a military goal since the early 2000s to cut the tether to fuel, as Jim Mattis said. The point was to make the United States military and everybody who's transporting that fuel less vulnerable because we need less of it. But another reason is simply that it's time to rethink all of these missions and bases for three reasons. One, some of them are already vulnerable and, in fact, inundated because of climate change.
Inundated, you mean literally with water?
That's correct. They're regularly, tides wash over and through bases. And then, of course, Norfolk Naval Base is sinking relative to sea level. And there are other bases which are experiencing extreme heat. The installation that the Navy has in the Arctic is vulnerable because of the permafrost melting. The buildings are literally shifting. There are many reasons why the installations are vulnerable, and the DoD has done a study of this and said that 77, I think, are right now experiencing or will soon experience difficulties because of climate change-related conditions.
So that might argue what, for doing away with them altogether, relocating them? What's the thought there?
There's the necessity for base realignment and closure because the U.S. military has more bases, in fact, probably than it needs.
Something we here on Cape Cod are intimately familiar with, yes.
Right. Another reason to look at this is that some of these installations and bases, which are not necessary any longer or are vulnerable, could be converted to other uses. For example, they could be places where the United States invests instead in renewable energy, which is actually a much better producer of jobs than military spending. So military spending produces something like 9 jobs directly and indirectly per $1 million spent. But if you look at alternative or clean energy, that is a greater producer as well as solar, those produce almost twice as many jobs per $1 million spent. So if we're talking not millions, but billions, you can see that this would be a great boost to the economy. In addition, those bases and installations could be converted to places where there's reforestation, which would sequester carbon. There's a number of reasons, in fact, that we need to rethink the bases.
So are you suggesting we should be redirecting military funding to address climate change?
I'm suggesting that we rethink the U.S. military budget and line it up with actual threats. Climate change is a real threat. It's urgent. It started by changing the profile of the missions and the use of U.S. resources, military resources. We could both diminish the risks that we fear from climate change, including climate war, and actually reduce the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere, or even engage in sequestration at these converted military bases. There are lots of opportunities here.
Nita Crawford, you've studied the military for a large chunk of your career and have been looking at specifically of late the carbon footprint of the military. As you've said, military officials, high-ranking military officials, recognize the national security risks and the threats directly to our military installations that climate change does pose. And they've said that they do need to reduce their reliance on fossil fuels. You've made the argument that the military needs to decarbonize. What does that mean in your mind? Are you talking about a zero carbon military? And how much further does your idea of what the military needs to do go than what military officials have committed to?
Well, the military has actually separated the two issues of reducing fossil fuel consumption for those operational reasons that I discussed. And they've put in a different category altogether the threat of climate change. They act as if climate change related inundation or their bases and challenges to operations and even climate war are almost a fait accompli, without recognizing their own contribution. So the first step would be for them to put the two things together and then develop a list of priorities for reductions in emissions. I don't know how they could go to zero. That would mean really changing a lot about their fuel consumption. They're even looking, in fact, into alternative jet fuels that are biofuels. All of those things are possible, but we must relate missions and risks and vulnerabilities. They can't be separate.
That's Nita Crawford. She's co-director of the Costs of War Project based at the Watson Institute at Brown University, a professor of political science at Boston University, and a board member of the Council for a Livable World. You can find her writing about the carbon footprint of the military on theconversation.com. Nita, thanks.
My pleasure.
And that's our show. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.